Today, I am joined, I'm happy to say, by legendary YouTuber, writer, podcaster, former politician, and overall Renaissance man of the internet age, Carl Benjamin, a.k.a. Sargon of Akkad. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me. That was a very kind introduction.
I am a fan, I have to say, and I've been a fan for quite a few years. And probably surprising to you, we actually have met in person at one point. I went to the fated discussion you had with Yaron Broke at...
Oh, really?
Yes. And I remember I was at UCL and then Antifa came and it was a whole thing. Mm. I don't know, I was at the bar, leave my coat, some type of bar type situation. And then I just turned around and you were doing the same thing. And I was just kind of shocked and said, hi. You said... Hi, strange woman. And that was pretty much our interaction. But I remember it and I was like, yeah, you know, I have met celebrities. And
God, I wouldn't call myself a celebrity.
You were definitely a celebrity to me because, you know, I was someone who's, you know, I came to see you speak. And unfortunately, I missed it because there was a location change at one point.
Well, we did get attacked by Antifa, but it turned out okay in the end, but it was fine.
Yeah, it was an interesting outing. I ended up talking to quite a lot of people. That was while I was still kind of in my libertarian phase. And if I remember correctly, it was organized by libertarians at UCL or something like that.
Yeah.
So that was an interesting experience. But I was kind of, obviously, I've been following your career since then and seeing kind of how you've evolved. And I feel like there's kind of a bit of convergent evolution here. And I see that a lot of people who used to be in the so-called, maybe new atheist, anti-woke space from back then, like 2016, 17, 18, haven't really arrived at this point. Like there have been quite a few parting of ways. A lot of people are just still kind of just anti-woke. A lot of people are, manning the barricades for liberalism. But you seem to have kind of slipped into a more post-liberal mindset. And I wonder if we could explore that a little bit and kind of how you come to these strange shores and what it was maybe that prompted you to explore this stuff. Because a lot of people don't really like to go this way. They feel like, dragons lie here and, you shouldn't even think about things in this direction. But you have, and I wonder what it was that sparked this this change.
The impetus for going down the road that I've gone down was to understand the philosophical foundations of what wokeness was, because I still have liberal instincts. I still want to see people treated fairly and well and all this sort of thing. But it was clear that there was something wrong with liberalism, and that's how wokeness managed to take advantage of it and conquer every liberal institution. One of the things that the sort of anti-woke classical liberal types, libertarians, never ask themselves is, it's why are we always on the defensive? How are they the ones in the institutions, in the positions of power? And how are we the ones who are constantly pleading with them, appealing to the conscience of the people making these decisions? Because we don't have any other means of persuading them. And so I spent a long time reading the canonical core of critical race theory, which is essentially what woke is, just top to bottom, really. And it turns out that it's a way of exploiting liberalism, using its own mechanisms in the Civil Rights Act and its own doctrine of human rights. And then I started considering, okay, well, how is that possible? What is about liberalism that leaves it open and vulnerable? Because it's all well and good saying, well, we just need to get rid of woke and then the problem is solved. But actually, the genie's out of the bottle, the cat's out of the bag. It was something that was probably inevitably going to happen, intersectionality. And so the question is, okay, what philosophical structures in liberalism allow it to work? And so I started sort of reverse engineering liberalism, going back through the core doctrine. And I essentially came to the conclusion that, well, it's not really true, which is always difficult if you pride yourself on actually caring about the truth, right? It's the original premises of liberalism came from a time where we simply didn't know that much about the world, about history, about how human beings actually are. And it was based on a series of false presuppositions that not only are not true, but have logical consequences that go beyond what the early thinkers of the Enlightenment thought they would go to. And we are now hundreds of years past that point, and we are seeing the excesses. And so I really find myself speaking against liberalism now, because the core aspect of it that I think is really important is that people in the modern era don't really realize how heavy society was in the pre-modern era, right? You had actual social ranks that you were born into, and in some countries you would die in with no chance of leaving. And this felt intolerable and oppressive, especially as the West was becoming incredibly prosperous through the discovery of the New World and trade and colonization. And so there were lots of people who felt actually oppressed by this circumstance. And I think I probably would have been one of those people had I lived in that time as well, being someone who is confident in my own agency and is capable of building things. And so liberalism seems like a very sensible thing in that time and place, because it is really, and the most core feature of it is the severing of social bonds. That's what it's for. It was designed to sever the thick social bonds that pinned people in place in society and reified the hierarchy in which they lived. And so in its time, it seemed logical and sensible to do that. And liberalism's arguments were so persuasive in its own context that it conquered the world. It was easily the most powerful ideology for the last 200, 300 years. And it's defeated all comers. You know, the fascists got crushed, the communists absolutely lost. And so they have had to resort to subversion, right? The Soviet Union would have preferred simply to have rolled tanks into Western Europe, but they couldn't. And the Soviet Union collapsed. And so now they are in our institutions working on the flaws in liberalism to arrive at their goal, which is something we can't really stop, because the flaws in liberalism they are approaching us through are ones that we essentially consent to. And so these premises that we consent to, they can just continue to exploit for an extreme purpose. And so going back to the social bond thing, I think this is the most important thing, is it is impossible for liberalism to actually build social bonds. And the way it tries to compensate for that is the social contract. But the social contract is in and of itself merely a fiction, and also not something to which people are actually particularly sentimentally attached. And you can see this in the way that partisan politics is completely ruining the West at this point. If you genuinely believe in a social contract, then both sides would say, well, obviously I'm not going to deplatform my opponent, because contractually, under the social contract, they have a legal right to freedom of speech and a moral right to freedom of speech, and they'll be Voltaire about it. I'll defend to the death your right to say it. But of course, that's not happening, right? That's not happening. We are seeing the platformings being cheered, not just on one side either. You know, the Republicans have caught up to where the Democrats have been for the last 10 years, and like, no, actually, screw you guys. You know, we need to win this war, and they do need to win this war. And so it is from these fictions and also the logical endpoint of liberalism that I found myself coming out of it, because I think actually when you step back and take a more sober look at what really human life is, because one of the problems with liberalism is it's very idealistic, and it makes people blind in its idealism towards what it could be to have a human life. But then if you actually look at it, it's very utilitarian and flat, and ends up becoming quite empty and purely pleasure-seeking. And that's really not what the genuine value and content of a human life should be. The genuine value that I think really exists in human life is in our relationships. And this is something that people like Aristotle have known for thousands of years. You know, this there's a whole conservative tradition that has, lay conservative tradition, so we call it, that has understood that actually, you know, the things that truly make us happy aren't possessions, they're the people that we love. and to be a member of a community in which we feel that we belong and which we have a home and which we feel that we can flourish and we can feel we can have agency on the community to help it grow and be better. And the purpose of liberalism is to destroy that. And it can't admit it. You know, it just can't admit it, but it will end up valuing freedom above all things. And freedom in this case, because again, when liberalism was first conceived, the state was simply not capable of being as powerful as it was in the 20th century. And honestly, I think maybe the totalitarianism of the 20th century gave liberalism a new life. It's like, well, hang on a second. We've got a doctrine against the state. That's great. But you also have a doctrine against society itself. And it is this that I think we're seeing the very end point where it is just about your rights and not about your duties to others. In fact, no one ever mentions duties. This is why Jordan Peterson was such a phenomenon. He was like, well, look, don't you think you have some duties to others? And everyone was like, what? I don't even know what that word means. You know. And so this is the problem, I think, at bottom with liberalism and why I no longer call myself a liberal. I'm actually not interested in destroying all bonds of fellowship in society. And the liberals won't admit that that's what they're doing, but it is absolutely what they're doing. And I don't think it should be continued.
Yeah, no, that's a really good summary and kind of maps well onto my trajectory, though. I feel like for me, it was a little bit more personal because I feel like I've kind of experimented just living out these philosophies a little bit because, you know, I come from a small town in Romania. It was very kind of, homogenous and restrictive type of place, a place where, you know, feminism kind of makes sense if you're like a smart, whatever, 14-year-old girl. And, you know, new atheism is also really interesting because it's obviously this high status, extremely, cognitively demanding, especially, you know, if you're 14 and this is your second language, you know, and you can understand this stuff, you feel like, you know, you've just unlocked the key to the universe. You know, these scientists are telling you what's real. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I kind of drifted into this kind of rationalistic, you know, reason cult, very utilitarian. And then, you know, living life, you know, you bounce against the limits of reason, the limits of the concept of the individual. Like the more I was trying to kind of brute force myself into all sorts of reasonable patterns of living that I expected myself to abide by, because, you know, they made sense on paper, like in my napkin calculation, they all made sense, but it resulted in a really dysfunctional way of living. So I kind of had to, you know, philosophically explore. My shift was essentially from kind of this utilitarian worldview, because you also mentioned utilitarianism, to something closer to virtue ethics, which I think is something that maps on fairly well for a lot of post-liberals. But that's kind of in a short lifespan, so just by seeing what works. And I feel like, obviously, you know, I've had similar thoughts, as you described, but I feel like I kind of tested it on my own person a little bit more.
That's very interesting, actually, because, I mean, you are right. I'm seeing a lot of people in the post-liberal space who are essentially just returning to Aristotle. And there are philosophical critiques of Aristotle. Obviously, there have been for thousands of years. But I think that the genuine core of what he was saying is true and quite uncontrovertibly true as well, actually. You know, the purpose of life is a human flourishing within a community, and therefore family, friends, virtue, and duty are just the most essential things to what a human life really consists in. And it's when you think about it, it's kind of wild, actually, that liberalism literally doesn't have anything to say about your obligations to other people. Like, it literally says, well, look, just don't interfere with them and then that's fine. And it's like, really? Really? That's the sum total of a human's moral obligation, is it? Don't interfere with someone else. But what if you need to? You know, what if that person's like, and this is why what's really interesting about like the social contract is it has to make provision for, say, phoning an ambulance when someone's, hurt on the street. In America, you have like these Good Samaritan laws that ensure that you're not going to get in trouble and you feel you are legally obligated to call ambulances. In some states, I think it is. But in a lot of places in Europe, you don't have that. And so it's interesting how you've got like social contract theory applying itself in Europe without the necessary sort of add-ons onto that the Americans clearly realized they were going to need. Because of course in Europe, you would feel morally obligated to help your countrymen. You know, you're like, well, the guy's hurt. You know, I should call an ambulance. I should try and help him, do whatever I can, right? But in a social contract society, you don't actually have that emotion. That's no. You were told, don't interfere with people. You were literally told, don't interfere with people. That's the moral standard, is non-interference. And so in America, you get some really abhorrent things happening. Like there was a woman in Philadelphia who was raped on a train in front of 30 people. And I'm just like, okay, but what does the social contract tell us? Well, not my problem. You know, I'm not the one violating our rights. Someone call the police. You know, eventually the authorities will come along and arrest this no good rapist on the train. And it's like, yeah, but wouldn't it have been better had three or four guys intervened, restrained this guy, stopped him from raping her, and then, you know, that would have been a better circumstance for everyone, would it not? You know, but this requires a sentimental view of society. If you view the people around you as just I don't know, strangers, aliens, but we all agree to a doctrine of rights, so they won't interfere with me, I won't interfere with them, then why would I expect any help from them at all? Whereas if you're in, like you say, you know, like an old settled society that has evolved and hasn't been crafted, then you absolutely expect that people will come and help you if you need help. You know, you would absolutely expect that. And you would do that for others. You would feel a duty of obligation. And the more I've been thinking about it, the more it's just like, well, who wants to live in the society where they are literally the atomized individual that no one cares about? Who wants that? It's like, well, think of the material wealth. You're going to be able to consume all day. You're going to have as much pornography as you want. You're going to be living in the pug, the pod. You're going to be eating the bugs. You're going to be have the VR headset on, and you are going to be stimulated. And so you'll be living in the utilitarian paradise where nothing but pleasure all day, every day, until one day you die and no one remembers you. And it's like, yeah, I actually don't think that's what's good for humanity. I actually have come to the conclusion that might actually be evil, actually. And I use the word evil deliberately, as in this is a circumstance with malintent towards us, as in this is, you know, something we should be looking at and going, no, these are vices and we should be minimizing them. And again, you don't need to be monomaniacal about these things. Obviously, everyone has vices. You know, I like to smoke. I don't drink much, actually, but, you know, everyone's got their vices. It's about making sure that these don't outweigh your virtues. And if you make your life dedicated to your vices, well, you're probably not going to be a very healthy person, probably not going to be a very happy person, and you're going to need the constant physical stimulation in order to mask the hollowness of your own life and the unhappiness that generates. And I just don't think that's very advisable. And I can't in good conscience advise something like that. It's not a good time to date, it seems. I'm married, so it's not my problem, but I hear from lots of people in their 20s, they're like, man, you're like, hey, you should get married, have kids, you'll be happy. And I would be happy if I could find a wife or if I could find a husband who was worth anything, because a lot has been done in the name of the social contract at this point. And it's not easy, but I think that's really the only place to go. Like, there's not really much else. I mean, again, if you go back like 50 or 100 years, one of the things we used to have is a very strong civil society in which there were lots of groups and clubs that you could go to and become a member of. So let's assume you were a spinster or a bachelor and you couldn't find a wife, you couldn't find children, you couldn't have children. You could still be involved in a local community, and that does still exist to some extent. But whenever you get involved in it, like my wife joined the local council recently, and I was like, oh, okay, that's great, you know. You know, I mean, it doesn't pay anything or anything, but, you know, she's getting involved. It gives her something to do. I was like, what's it like? And they're all over 60. They're all really, really old. And she thinks that the reason that she got accepted onto it is really because she's not 60. And that tells you a lot about the local areas and what young people are like in the local areas. They're not getting involved in the way that they would have done in generations past. So you've got a general kind of collapse of civil society. You've got the deliberate atomization of people. And is it any wonder that people are lonely and depressed and have skyrocketing drug use? And I don't know what we can do about it apart from say, well, look, this is the consequence of liberalism. And so we need some kind of conservative vision.
Yes, I think that's kind of the point that I've arrived at as well. And it's a weird position to be in, because, you know, I was very much a fan of the classical liberal vision until I played out the thought experiment, and it really came up short. And it came up short, especially, unfortunately, Because libertarianism seems to me to be kind of like this crystallized form of super liberalism, like the thing that we all kind of were gravitating towards, like, okay, this is going to free us from the state. It's actually been the most effective handmaiden of the encroach. Not only did it obviously allow the market to expand to the size that it has, it also has expanded the state. I think people tend to not realize how much libertarianism has been kind of a solvent, or not necessarily politically organized libertarianism, because libertarianism politically organized is not really very successful, but libertarianism as a force within conservative parties, because you kind of have this, you know, the Reaganite consensus, fusionism, things like that, which have a kind of a libertarian core, which managed to not only deregulate financial markets, which had obviously, you know, crazy consequences on boom and bust cycles, but also managed to, accept any sort of libertarianism coming from the left, which is the only type of libertarianism that you can actually put into practice politically that people will accept, like, you know, abortion laws, legalizing the sex trade, legalizing gambling. Like the flavor of, you know, sports betting and gambling that you reach now is like people, you know, pissing themselves in front of slot machines and things like that. This is, you know, this is this degeneracy at a level that you couldn't even imagine, and it's all been, you know, lubricated in by libertarian thinking in both the left and right. So I definitely would not be part of the London Libertarian Society anymore, because it feels to me like that's the blindness that I saw once I could see in libertarianism itself is just astounding.
No, I think you're totally right about that, and I would definitely describe myself as a social conservative now. I mean, again, to discuss the classical liberal doctrine of the state is to essentially discuss English political tradition, right? Because that's where it's come from. That's what the impetus for it was. And it was the extraction of that into a doctrine that could be taken to other times and places is one of the things that made it so successful. And so as an Englishman, I mean, obviously I'm going to agree with the basic premises of classical liberalism. Obviously the state shouldn't be able to take my property. Obviously I should have certain political rights, et cetera, et cetera. But that's a very narrow band of life that we're really dealing with there. And, you know, I mean, I actually don't interact with the state a great deal. You know, it's when they say, oh, you owe us some taxes, mostly, that is my interaction with the state. And so I grit my teeth, grudgingly pay my taxes, and I get closer to an ANCAP position on everything. But the when it comes to expanding that doctrine of libertarianism to like this beyond the state and into all realms of society, you realize it's just not really fit for purpose, right? The utilitarians, I think, are kind of guilty of this as well by conflating happiness with pleasure. And we arrive at just a position where it just encourages hedonism in everything. And if you speak out against this, it makes it sound like, oh, are you some sort of prude that doesn't want anyone to have fun ever? No, I'm not that. I believe in moderation, actually. You know, like, I do agree that you should have fun. You know, you should spend a couple of hours every evening doing something fun that you've enjoyed because you've had a long, hard day at work and you've been, you know, productive, you've been responsible, you've dealt with your wife, dealt with the kids. And this is very much talking about my own life. I deserve an hour or two in the evening playing a couple of video games, right? I totally accept that. But that's just not the way that things are going now, right? People are drinking to excess, they're taking drugs to excess, they are playing video games all day, they don't read books, they don't do anything really productive, and they slave away in a job they do the minimum effort, minimum number of hours for. And that's our fire alarm, so I apologize. I should have remembered that it goes off at 10 o'clock every morning. So they find themselves just trapped in a cycle where they hate their own lives, and therefore excess is the only thing to do in order to alleviate the suffering and the boredom of it. And so naturally the well-meaning progressive will say, okay, well, don't we need UBI then so people aren't trapped in jobs they hate? It's like, brilliant. Oh, brilliant. What do you think that's going to create? You know, give people $2,000 a month or however much it is and see what drug usage and alcohol usage turns into. Like, it's just not good for people. It's going to create loads more social ills as if we don't have enough already. It's going to create health crises. It's going to create all sorts of negative outcomes. Whereas we really should be thinking about living sort of a balanced life. Again, I hate to just go back to Aristotle, right? But like, he was just so right about the golden mean. He was just obviously right. Don't do anything to excess or deficiency. Do things about the right amount. And that's using your prudent judgment, right? You have to judge. You have to be responsible for when you think you've done this too much or you've done not enough. You know, like you probably don't do enough exercise, not you personally, but people watching this, you probably don't. And if you do, maybe you're doing it too much. If you're down the gym all day, every day, then you are definitely doing it too much and you're letting other aspects of your life degrade that you need to shore up. If you'd never see your friends, well, make plans to, at least like once a month. But if you see them every night, you're doing that too much. You need to calm down. It's just so obvious that this is a much more healthy way for a human being to live, compared to the future we're heading into. Man, I would just feel totally irresponsible not promoting something like this as well. Just moderation in all things is just the answer, I think.
Yes, I mean, that's kind of what I try to model for my kids as well.
And the problem with it, though, is it's not sexy, right? It's hard to sell. Like, it's not like, hey, this is going to be amazing. You're going to be a multi-billionaire. You're going to have women hanging off your arm. You know, Andrew Tate has got a lifestyle of excess that is very easy to sell to young men. But in the same way, like Pleasure Island from Pinocchio, you know, it's like, hey, you know, come over here. But it's like, look, it's going to turn you into a braying jackass and you won't even know why that's bad by the end of that road. And I don't even despise Andrew Tate or anything. I think it was kind of a rational response to the degenerate world in which we live, right? It's like, well, look, if everything is as stripped down and materialist and ignoble as things appear to be, then actually Andrew Tate isn't an irrational response. And people liking Andrew Tate and wanting to emulate him is not irrational either. But I think even Andrew Tate would say, well, look, I mean, I think there's a reason he's converted to Islam, right? Because he's like, hang on a second, actually, this isn't good. And this culture and civilization isn't good. And if we hadn't removed all of the dignity from human life in the way that liberalism has done, then actually maybe Andrew Tate wouldn't be an aspirational figure. But what are you going to do?
I think it's, you know, it does make a lot of sense that he's kind of an outgrowth of all of this, especially for young men who feel deprived. Like we're it's essentially the theme in Fight Club. You know, we were promised to be movie stars, but essentially you're just like a neat in your mom's basement, and you know, and you're surrounded by all of this kind of super stimulus of all of these aspirational things. And then Andrew Tate, obviously, he shows you the super stimulus, but he also kind of says that you know, it's okay to, you know, disregard all of the norms that people have imposed on you that limit you from achieving the super stimulus. And if you only pay for Hustlers University or whatever this program is called, you can, you know, hack your mind to overcome the limitations that society has imposed on you, especially by women, you know, conquer as men are supposed to conquer, as your ancestors did in the olden days. Yeah, so I think, very, very much a rational response to what's out there.
Yeah. I don't really know what can be done either. Like, the moral revolution against this would have to be so wide-ranging and so complete that actually I think the only real thing to do is ride the tiger, as it were, and let the thing burn itself out. And this is, interestingly, an issue that John Stuart Mill came to the same conclusion. It's like, we would need a revolution in sentiments so vast and so not just comprehensive, but cognizant of what it was doing and why it was doing it, that he just didn't see it happening. And this is why he thought that socialism wasn't really possible. And this is why I think maybe traditionalism isn't really possible in the way that I think that we're describing it. And it would require a total collapse of the system in order to force people into new ways of life. And as I think the system is probably going to limp on for at least a number of decades further yet, it looks like we're probably bound to be voices in the wilderness. Although, saying that, I'm being too pessimistic there, but I have seen good movements on the right that are growing in confidence to their ability to speak about just more wholesome ways of life, the genuine human good of what family and country and duty actually are. There has been a voice beginning to articulate itself. And so maybe I'm just being excessively pessimistic on a Monday morning or something. But I mean, maybe. I'm actually a natural optimist. But the realist in me has to look at the future and be like, it's not going to be good.
Yeah, I'm similarly very black-pilled on the macro scale and quite white-pilled on the micro scale. Like, I feel like, you know, if you are faced with a universal solvent and you are, you know, you are one and you have a family or a small community or something like that, the only place you can functionally reverse entropy is in your own backyard. And, you know, by the, you know, I'm going to sound like Jordan Peterson, but by the acts that you you choose, you know, as an individual.
It's totally true, though.
Yeah, this is it. I mean, this is has been the only thing that actually had, you know, positive ROI in my own life. And, you know, just trying my best every day and not being a slob and not, you know, just cleaning my room and doing all the basic stuff.
But it's totally true. And the thing is as well, right, this is where the left totally fails to understand society and human nature, right? Like, they view all of our civilization as a series of abstract classes. And the classes themselves take on a kind of like noumenal aspect. They're like things that exist, really. But actually, they're not real, and they don't really exist. And when you look at any of the thing that they're trying to point to you, you see a person, right? Because a person is a real thing. And actually, you realize that all of the things that we have and take for granted are the sort of composite of many, many, many small things. I mean, literally like the atoms that make up a table or make up in a chair. Like, if you just zoom in on them, they're actually very, very small. And when you look at those things, the quality of the people, the individual people themselves, really matters, right? And this is one of the fears on the right at the moment, is that lowering standards is going to start leading to planes dropping out of the sky and things like that. And it probably will. I mean, it's probably not an irrational fear. But this speaks to exactly what I'm trying to get across, where it's like, look, the quality of the people and the quality of their relationships, and that is the bedrock, that is the substratum of the quality of the community, is the quality of the class, which is the quality of the nation. And these things are not separated as the left would like to describe them in the way that they conceive these things, is if they're not connected. So no, there's not only a direct connection, one relies on the other. And so if the quality of the people goes down, then the quality of our civilization goes down and the quality of our societies goes down, the quality of everything, and things will stop working. And so to say, well, I just look at my own life and try and improve it. Well, I mean, that's really all anyone should be doing, right? That's not only like, you know, the best solution to all of this is when people in general, like, well, what can I do better? It's always good to promote a sense of personal agency, but that's how good things are built, right? They're not built from the top down, actually. And it is, and again, that's not a popular thing to say on the right, but actually there's obviously a lot to it. The quality of the education of the individuals, the actions that they take, the bonds that they build, these small societies, the little platoons that they form, all of these are the sort of lifting up of civilization. This is what builds up the traditions, builds up the institutions that maintain the memory of what's right and what's wrong and how to get a prosperous and productive society that everyone's happy to live in. And so actually, really, the step is you personally, what are you doing? I mean, and there are going to be people like, okay, that all sounds very abstract. What's that supposed to mean? And that means phone your mother right now. Stop this interview. Pick up the phone and just phone up your mum, right? Phone up your dad, phone up one of your friends. Like, literally get off the internet, stop talking to no one, and go and actually interact with another human being that you care for. That's what I mean, literally in these concrete terms, right? Because there are people, oh, they're, you know, so abstract. No, it's not abstract, actually. You know, do it. Just literally do it. Nice. And that is, just do a small thing like that every single day, and not only will it become second nature, right? You'll find yourself enjoying it. You'll find yourself realizing why people always used to do these things prior. And before you know it, without you even thinking about it consciously, as a residue of these activities, you will find yourself with a network of people who you love and love you back. They will be there when you need them. And so if something goes wrong, the first person you phone will be there to help. The second person you phone will be there to help. And you'll realize you're not on your own. You actually have a support network of people who love and care about you. And they will, this is the sort of thing that if you embody the act, then it will be an inspiration to others. They'll be like, yeah, no, so-and-so always phones me up. Yeah, I should probably do that to my mum. You know, I should probably do that to my dad. I should probably give my sister a ring, meet up, you know, we'll take the kids to the beach or something. You know, so like whatever it is. And this is what the the substratum of civilization actually is. It's people doing things for each other and with each other. And if you don't do it, it won't happen. And the more you do it, the stronger it gets. And the less you put it, you do it, the more you put it off, the weaker it gets. And the more tenuous these bonds become. And so it really is just about you personally, stop consuming, go and see someone you like.
Yeah, I think that's an extremely valuable recommendation. And I think the problem that you have, especially on the internet, is that, you know, self-improvement has been focused almost exclusively on the self. You kind of have this this grind set idea where you go into monk mode and you don't check your phone and, you know, you keep grinding away at your dropshipping business and things like that. And then you make enough money so that you qualify to eventually be social and go to the cool parties that you always wanted to go to. Well, obviously not calling your mom and, you know, ignoring your friends or whatever, ignoring any opportunities to make friends. And it's really isolating because, you know, when I said that, you know, I was someone who's, you know, tried to rationalistically push themselves in directions like that, I was kind of hooked into things like that, you know, self-improvement, you know, the idea that one day, if I really think about it hard, if I have a theory to put to my life that will give me the steps to, you know, to accomplish X or Y, then that will be the day where I'm actually, you know, worthy of participating in life, you know, as other people know it. So it's a mirage. And I feel like more people should understand that, but it's really hard because I think a big problem with the internet is that it is video based, visual based, and text based. And that is kind of forcing language and forcing a lot of things that are, you know, it's in themselves logical and rationalistic, like just the way we communicate and the way we get information from the internet. It's kind of hooking you into a certain way of being in the world, way of thinking about the world, about yourself. That is not complete. It's very narrow and people don't understand that because a lot of, there's this, even in self-development, people have kind of realized that, you know, you can't really think your way into a new way of acting. You have to start acting a certain way and just doing the same repetitions of certain things. And the actual physical act of doing something changes you into a different type of person. And that's just kind of a very like basic intro insight. But I think that's kind of the insight, the fact that language is very limited. Thinking about these things in these parameters is super limited. And, you know, you need to kind of break out of that because you're in a loop. You can think yourself into like immense loops. And I think a lot of mental disorders and things that we see nowadays are because people just are stuck in language and they're trying to think themselves out of all sorts of problems that they've already fought themselves into. And it's just, it really is exhausting. And I can understand why people, you know, are malfunctioning.
I think the point about the grind set on the internet is a very interesting one, because you are right that the internet essentially is, especially social media in particular, is essentially a vector for narcissism. And this is essentially what we see from many, not just left-wing influencers, obviously right-wing influencers as well. And it's not that they are wrong in promoting a healthy lifestyle or to be strong or to be, you know, to be buff, whatever it is. It's not the wrong to do this. It's just that the intention ends up seeming very much like it's for its own sake, whereas actually physical strength, physical fitness was normally a residue of doing something else, right? You're a warrior and therefore you practice every day and therefore you end up with a great physique because you are trained for war or something like that. But in this case, you've got the people who literally just go to a gym to get a great physique. Okay, but for what reason? It's like, well, I want to look good on the internet. I want to look good in real life. It's like, okay, why? You know, what's the purpose? And it's all vanity at the end of the day. It all comes down to a kind of self-serving, honestly, kind of libertarian perspective on, you know, it's all about me. I'm the center of the universe. And it's like, okay, but there are other reasons why you wouldn't do that. And at the end of the day, vanity is not something that is going to sustain you forever. I mean, you've all read The Picture of Dorian Gray. You know, you're going to get old at some point and you're going to hate the way that you look and you're going to look at yourself and go, oh, my good looks. So yeah, but they weren't going to last. You know, however, your relationships can last. You know, you can have friends that literally last a lifetime, that you have just a richer friendship with the longer you've known them. and the more you do together, you know, and the same with your kids and your spouse, these things can be a source of happiness for you that don't go away. And I know that the counter as well, you know, I'm in control of my gym activity, right? I can go to the gym whenever I want and I'm disciplined. I go to the gym and therefore it's like, yeah, I know it's kind of scary to kind of cede control of your relationship to someone else, because you kind of are whenever you have a relationship. It's two parts, right? It's, you know, it's you and someone else. And there's an element of trust there and it requires other people's input and et cetera, et cetera. And so it's not entirely within your control. And I can totally see why you're like, well, I'm going to pick the one that is entirely in my control because at least I'm certain of that. But life isn't actually made up of certainties. Life is made up of probabilities. And the sooner you come to grips with that, the more complacent, not complacent, the more sanguine you will be about the way that your life is. And suddenly you realize, actually, no, I've got a bunch of good relationships. I don't have to be in control of them. I'm happy with what I'm doing. Maintain a, you know, a level of relatively good fitness, obviously. And suddenly you realize that it's not, you don't have the sort of fragile ego that vanity breeds. Suddenly you feel confident and secure in yourself. You've built up a stable of skills. You've built up stable of relationships. And you can be relied upon by other people, right? Because, I mean, like, this is the thing that I always... Again, I feel kind of bad for Andrew Tate in a way, right? Because nobody relies on Andrew Tate, right? Nobody gets up in the morning and goes, God, I hope Andrew does this for me or that for me. They don't think that. What, like, Andrew Tate, like, has to operate like a compound. And, you know, I've seen clips of him where he's essentially saying, look, you can't let the girls escape or have relationships with other people. And so Andrew Tate is acting kind of like an emotional jailer in a way. And that's the total opposite of how my relationships are. You know, my relationships are people relying on me for things. And so I don't have to try and imprison them in some way. You know, I don't worry about them running off. You know, they don't want to. They want to stay with me, which is nice. You know, so my relationship dynamics are very clearly the opposite of Andrew Tate's, right? And I look at him and I feel kind of bad. Because his need for control comes from a position of profound insecurity, whereas I feel very secure in my life and my relationships and my business and the things that I do. And so I feel much more serene than I think that Andrew Tate is. And I would prefer to feel the way I feel than the way he feels.
Yeah, I think you make a really good point that I think a lot of people miss about what is the essence of patriarchy? You know, what does it mean to be, you know, to provide that headship, to provide leadership, to, you know, the thing that, you know, we're obviously kind of missing in society and that women obviously also kind of crave, but also don't know how to communicate. It is this beaming out of, okay, I am, you know, I have core competence at living life, and I have these people who are not dependent on me, like, okay, you're in the basement and I got the keys, but they're dependent on me because they want to be, you know, they admire what I have to offer. There's a lot of, you know, things coming out about, you know, people who are kind of really fetishizing this trad ideal. And, you know, there are, you know, a lot of men who obviously like the idea of having a submissive wife and a lot of women who kind of like the idea of being a submissive as well. And they kind of pair up together and it leads to these like explosively abusive relationships that, you know, end in tears. And, you know, more and more of these are coming out. I think, you know, the fetishization of something versus what it actually is in reality are extremely far apart. And I feel like the internet also enables people to do that, again, through this kind of visual, text-based, meme-based, image-based ideal that, you know, the man wants the wife in the wheat field wants the logger type husband who's going to be a provider. Yeah. But they both aren't really that. And then they try to make it work as that, but reality just doesn't work that way.
Well, this is a major problem. I mean, it's probably the internet that is the real problem. But you could probably argue that mass media has always generated this kind of problem, which is just inauthenticity, right? You can persuade the thing, you can persuade people that you are the thing, then in their minds, you take on the aspect of the thing and they treat you as if you are the thing, whether or not you are actually the thing, right? And so this, and you see this, like there's a young lady who undoubtedly you've seen the videos where she's a very busty young lady and she is like, oh, I'm a trad wife and I make cakes. And she's very beautiful, very attractive. And she's dressed in, you know, a trad dress, but the trad dress is very figure hugging. And this is very clearly a kind of fetish. And I don't, you know, judge people at all. You know, she's a good marketer for what she's doing, right? But that's not really what the life is like of being a married person who has a stay-at-home wife. And I know because I'm a married person who has a stay-at-home wife. A lot of the time, it's just, you know, compromise and work, right? You know, we've got four kids, so we've got to spend a lot of time cleaning up after them and chasing them around and stop them from breaking stuff, stop them from hurting themselves. You know, Dad, can you do this? Dad, can you do that? It's fine, right? It's all totally fine. But it's not. But that's an authentic thing that I very rarely put on the internet. Like most of my daily content is not, you know, look at me doing this thing. Look at, you know, my kids doing this thing. Occasionally I'll put that up because sometimes I'll do something really cute. But like, that's a sometimes, right? Most of the time it's not quite that easy. And you have responsibilities and standards that you have to uphold. But it's good for them. It's good for you. And it's good for the people around you. It's good for your local community to produce a good and healthy functional person. And so like when you look at the kind of reflecting mirror of social media and you see like the beautifully crafted trad wife where she's like, she's got perfect makeup, perfect hair. And she's there claiming to bake a cake. Bull. Just bull. And my wife falls for this all the time. She's like, this woman makes her own cheese. I'm like, no, darling, she doesn't make her own cheese. She made it once for this video that she puts up. And then she says, I make cheese every day for my husband. Bollocks to you. Just so much work. There is no way you do. I don't believe you do. You're a liar. You know? And so this is what I mean. Like the inauthenticity of the social media experience is deforming people's expectations. And I don't blame that there are, and I'm not surprised there are lots of young people like, yeah, I would like a traditional house and traditional life. So yeah, but the thing is you're going to ideologically persuade yourself, like trying to implement this into your life. And that really is not any way to do anything, right? I mean, A, you'll come out kind of like a little like domestic Hitler where you're like, no, you know, it has to be this, has to be that, has to be the other. And we see this in a lot of conservative influencers where they have a plan to make the domestic life that they think their great grandparents had. And it's like, no, that's just not how they came to it, right? They came to it through necessity and they came to it through action. They habitually did these things. And so, you know, the man did things through habit, the woman did things through habit. And I've seen loads of posts from young women who are like, well, my husband expected me to do all the housework and do all this thing and then treat him like a king. And it's like, where does he get these expectations from, right? It's like this is all ideological that has been formulated in the abstract on the internet. In reality, it's two people who love each other, who want to do the best they can for each other. You know, to have an abstract set of requirements is not the way to approach any kind of relationship. You should be, it should be something based on love rather than based on a series of literally like you're turning your relationship into a social contract, you know, and that's not serving either of you well. It's not making you happy because you're not getting these things that you have decided that you deserve. And your wife feels that she has to do way more than she's getting in return. Right. And so it's just a totally demented way of approaching human relationships. Again, it should be about negotiation, compromise, and love. You should be doing it because you want to do these things, and then she'll do things because she wants to do these things. And together you build something that is unique and only yours, right? You can't just say, right, well, here's a series of goals that I had and four out of five of them have been fulfilled or something. That's not how it works. And unfortunately, I mean, young people are just not being told how to be human beings these days. They're told how to be these atomized, isolated, rights-obsessed little consumers. And so it's no wonder that their relationships are failing. I don't know what can be done, really.
Yeah, I think that's definitely something that's fueling all the issues that your friends are also highlighting about dating, because everyone's coming to the table with this strange list of images and memes and expectations about not only what their partner should be like and how their life should be like, and the idea that, you know, that if this guy doesn't fit the list completely, maybe the next one will. And also, you know, jaded from, you know, having a lot of people not fit the list and having a lot of people maybe that you thought would fit the list to reject you, because, you know, if everyone's playing the game at a rapid rate, you're just going to be rejected quite a lot as well. And I feel like people just have just been self-traumatizing with internet generated ghosts essentially that they've you know, let themselves be poisoned with. And
that, sorry to interrupt, but that is exactly the way to say internet generated ghosts. I mean, one of the things that you see going around the internet all the time are people's, what's the name of the dating network? What's the dating network? I don't use dating
Tinder.
Networks.
Tinder,
right? Yeah, the Tinder bio screenshot, right? And you'll see this, and you see this on both sides, right? You see men and women both posting these things, where it's a series of unreasonable expectations. And some of these are just comically unreasonable, right? And that's why people post them. But there is a sentiment that is in both of these two spaces that is, oh my God, look at what I was expected of me, and look what this guy who's, or this girl who are relatively average, expect to find a partner. And to that, you just have to ignore it. Like, who cares what any man or woman's ideal is? Who cares? Like, let them go find it. Like, look at the world. It's not ideal. You aren't going to find ideal. You're going to find a reasonable compromise that you are happy with. And both sexes are going to do this. And if you don't do this, you're just going to be alone. So the quicker you get over this ideal list of things and the fact that other people have, don't listen to them. Like when people are, oh, I want a guy who's 6'6" and who earns £500,000. Who cares what she wants? She's not going to get that, you know? But if you're charming and friendly, you'll find a woman who actually likes you for the person that you are. She doesn't have just an abstract list. She was just charmed by you. There's a kind of magic that is created when two people find that they like each other. And this is what you should be thinking about. This is what you should look for. And this is what you should try and cultivate. And don't worry about these things. Don't worry about them. They're not important. They're never going to get what they want. And they are going to settle. They're going to compromise. They're going to settle for something that isn't, you know, Brad Pitt in a supercar or Megan Fox, you know, in a bikini or whatever, right? Do not worry about these things. People put nonsense in their bios. Just start talking to people. Start actually interacting. You know, be charming, be funny, be romantic, be whatever. But don't worry about the ideals. And I'm so sick of it. I mean, it's, honestly, young men are really bad for this. Young women probably are as well. But young men are really bad going, well, look at what women want now. Look at what women want now. I can't do that. And of course you can't do that. She's literally asking for a Greek demigod. Don't be stupid. No one's like that, you know, but she's never going to get it. So don't worry about it. Just get on with your life.
Yeah. And there's kind of the opposite as well, in the sense that people get scared of the, you know, there's just all this kind of divorce rape porn out there, yeah, that, you know, women will take you for everything you're worth. And, yeah, you know, I don't kind of father, what's that called? You know, paternity fraud and things like, yeah, that.
And these are real concerns.
Yeah, well. I think they are. But I think, you know, they are relatively, I mean, these are a few percentage points of the population, obviously a real concern, but it's not, most likely most people having relationships like this are probably going to be fine. But if you are on the internet and this is what you see, especially if you follow whatever feminist pages or manosphere pages, you literally see an onslaught of clips of the worst behavior of the opposite sex. Yeah. And then because you have this availability bias, and then these kind of explode in your mind, that so that you think, okay, the opposite sex is predatory. They want, yeah, to hurt me. Why would I want to expose myself to this? Especially if, you know, like anyone in life, you've had some, you know, unpleasant experiences, and this lets you take those unpleasant experiences and, you know, lift them to the level of personal philosophy. Okay, this is, you know, I'm done. You know, this kind of MGTOW type. And I'm not saying that some men don't have good reason to opt out. So as do a lot of women. You know, a lot of women just resort to lesbianism after a few of these rounds. That's just the female prerogative to move in with a girlfriend at the end of life. That's just the way it's been for a long time. But yeah, I mean, it's, I think like the internet really allows this, these niche phenomena to just be blown up into things that, you know, really are scary. And I understand, I mean, if you are in these spaces, I understand why you're afraid, because it really does look like, okay, these are apocalyptic level crises. But in reality, like you said, you know, if you're try to be charming, try to be funny, try to not look terrible, you probably find someone if you dare to look, if you dare to try, if you, you know, put yourself out there. I know this sounds like people will hate me in the manosphere for saying this, because, you know, just be charming, just be funny. But, you know, I personally know a lot of guys who are very, very average and below, who are married and have kids. You know, yeah, they still exist out there. You know, just go on the street and You'd be surprised by the non-Chads out there, you know, fornicating and producing offspring. It's crazy.
Well, one of the things I think is interesting about that is that when I've read a lot of accounts of my wife screwed me, my husband beat me, whatever it is. And it really does, in many ways, seem like there's a kind of, I want to frame this delicately because I don't want anyone being angry at me. There's definitely a lack of prudence in the decisions that have been made in this person's life. And I get the feeling, especially in a lot of men's cases, they've chosen a very attractive woman who is kind of unhinged in a way. They kind of knew that she wasn't good news necessarily, but she was very attractive and maybe very good in bed. And, you know, they made their decision based on that rather than other qualities. And so there's maybe a slightly more boring, more dowdy, like normal woman that they passed over for the very attractive and crazy woman who lives on a very highly strung emotional level. And therefore, when their relationship breaks down, it doesn't break down amicably in a way that both parties say, okay, well, I don't hate you, I don't want to hurt you. It breaks down and melts down. You know, there's a giant spectacular breakup. And so there's vengeful feelings that underpin that. And most relationships actually aren't, I've found, and not just in my own, but in other people's lives, I've seen most relationships are actually not vengeful meltdowns at the end of it. Most of it is, you know, maybe with a sense of loss and sorrow, actually, the relationship hasn't worked. And so I have friends who have been divorced, although most of my friends are actually married, now I think about it. But I've had friends who have been divorced, but it's never turned into the sort of American nightmare divorce that you always hear about, where she's ruining him. And I'm not saying that doesn't happen, and I'm not totally sympathetic to the guys who that happens to. But what I'm saying is I think actually a measure of prudence in advance can protect you. And there are going to be guys who say, yeah, well, I thought that this woman that I married was, you know, good and kind and decent. And she gave every indication up until she cheated on me. We got divorced. She took everything and I'm ruined. And all I can say is, man, I totally agree that the divorce laws need to be changed, right? I totally agree. But for most people, that isn't the case. And most women aren't malevolent and want to hurt you. And so you can, and I say this as a misogynist, right? So you can find decent people. You can have a decent life. It's still in reach. And as you were saying, it's a kind of self-selection bias that leads people down a rabbit hole thinking this doesn't exist. It does exist. And, you know, you should make good decisions to try and get it.
Yeah. I think a lot of people don't understand personality disorders. They're quite common. Like, you know, BPD for men is quite attractive because that's kind of like the manic pixie type sexy woman who's just, you know, spontaneous and erotic and things like that.
Yeah.
And for women, narcissism is very attractive because this is kind of the, you know, sweep you off your feet, you know, love bombing type of guy. And you know, these people attract, and especially they attract people who already maybe are a little bit vulnerable emotionally because they're these like extremely big personalities. They're super charming, and you know, they offer you a certain stimulus that is hard to find in reality. And a lot of people confuse that for love, you know, the extreme attention, you're the single point of focus for this person, and then they take the focus away and then they give it back. And there's like all these mind games that are super kind of delicious for especially a hurt ego, someone who maybe, you know, hasn't had, good experiences. So yeah, it's a trap. Life is full of traps out there, but yeah, don't generalize from the traps. Not everyone's like that.
No, that's totally true. That's totally true. And like, you can see how people whose lives are otherwise boring as well might be swept into that. But I know it's strange to like find myself making the argument for a boring, secure, normal life. But I think a lot of people need to hear it, and especially people in like online influencer spaces where they come into money and fame and popularity and it kind of goes to their head and they realize they can get a lot more than they otherwise would have done in their normal life prior. And so they go on a roller coaster ride. And I mean, I can name probably half a dozen for whom that's crashed at quite a young age, right? And so your job is to, you know, that may well happen to you, but even if it doesn't happen to you and you find success in other ways, your job is just to maintain a good life, right? Don't go off the rails. Don't try and push the boundaries too far. Just, again, it all comes back to Aristotle, you know, just be reasonable and try to be moderate and decent in the things that you do, and your life will go well, or at least a lot better than it would have done had you reached the highest highs and then crashed down to the lowest lows.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And I keep finding myself be extremely grateful for not finding Twitter maybe 10 years ago, or, you know, just completely. I would have definitely just bombed myself all over the internet, because not only did I not understand the internet, know, it was kind of a high tide for ideologies and whatever. I'd probably be in jail by now, probably some alt-right situation back then or so. So something really bad, or I'd definitely be, you know, someone that no one wants to talk to at this point. And now I feel like, you know, I'm now going to have my second son, and, you know, I'm married, and I only got on the internet kind of around the time I got married. So I was very settled and just curious about the actual ideas part of all of this. And I feel like it's been much more healthy way of entering, becoming some form of influencer in a more steady and not insane way, which, yeah, I could have imagined. I mean, just, you know, the hormones that you have as a young person, even as a woman, you know, it's there's a lot of energy in youth. Would have driven me to do very retarded things, unfortunately.
I'm so glad that the internet didn't exist when I was a teenager. Like, I dread to think what I would have put on the internet. And it's a record. Like, I feel bad for young people now. Just, you know, they undoubtedly look back at their posting history from like 5 years ago when they're like 23 and be like, what was I doing? God, I've got to delete that. You know, I'm so glad that I didn't have the internet then.
Yeah. I mean, on that note, and on with all the gratitude that we have that we're relatively normal people now, still on the internet, doing things on the internet, I want to ask you the last question. This is the question that everyone gets on the show. It is, do you have a subversive thinker, this would be kind of in the spirit of the show, that you think is underrated, that people maybe misunderstand or just don't look into enough or don't know about?
There's a great many thinkers that I respect that people don't talk about. I mean, I personally really like Michael Oakeshott, who was a conservative philosopher in the 20th century. And it was his work that genuinely got me genuinely got me thinking, actually, I think maybe I am a conservative. Maybe I want to stop being a liberal, because the problem with ideology itself is that it provides a ready suite of answers to a bunch of questions you don't really understand. And you have no practical knowledge of the things that you're doing. One of the complaints about politicians that a lot of people have is that they're not ideological, right? So a lot of them actually don't have any clear ideological goals. And I think this actually might be a consequence of them having practical experience of being a politician. And the people in the political space online who have no practical experience of that are very ideological, and myself included, back a few years ago. And you don't really know how things work. And so the ideology gives you a set of sort of a priori diktats that it's like, no, it should be this, it should be that, it should be the other, but you don't really know why. You know, it should be because someone has theorized this 200 years ago. No, not really. You know, it should be in certain ways that are drawn from the existing ways that things already are. And when you become a lot more connected to things, then you realize that they're a lot more complicated than an ideology would let you believe, and that there are things that you just don't understand. And it was Oakeshott that really got me to understand this in his essay, Rationalism and Politics. But he's got a few others as well that are just genuine gold. And he's got just this way of approaching things. Like a lot of continental philosophy is deliberately obtuse. Lots of people like Hegel and Nietzsche and various French thinkers, they coin terms, right, to mean specific things. And then they drag you down rabbit holes, which are usually totally worthless. But someone like Oakeshott just speaks in quite plain language. And if he has to define a term, he defines it simply. And he speaks plainly and just to say, well, look, this is what I've experienced. This is what I've seen. This is what I believe is a facet of life. And actually, if we look at this in a slightly different way, you'll realize why there are deficiencies in what is being done. And so his His Rationalism and Politics is a good way of essentially extracting yourself from ideology. It helps you get out of what is a predefined series of oughts that you didn't really know you were carrying around with you. You didn't really know were constraining your vision to the point that they are. And once you come out of ideology, you realize you can have an entire political life outside of ideology, and it's better for you as well. Because you are much more inclined to take things as they are and be satisfied with what you have than to compare the world to an ideal standard that doesn't exist anywhere and find everything wanting. You know, and so, and it was Michael Oakeshott who brought me genuinely out of ideology properly to really kind of understand where I want to be politically. And I would genuinely recommend this.
Yeah, that's an excellent recommendation. And it just, I think it's very timely, especially because, you know, I guess it's a legacy of the Enlightenment. I mean, it's been a while since we've introduced ideology into society, but it feels like now different ideologies are kind of more entrenched, and people really don't have a good framework to recognize the frameworks that they're already operating in. And I think that's excellent. So thank you so much for the recommendation, for coming on. And I want to point people towards your many hundreds of hours of content that you've put out there, and the podcast of the Lotus Eaters, your current project, and anything else that other people should check out.
Just lotuseaters.com really is where we do the bulk of our work, and I'm in the studio now, obviously. And it's going great, and very proud of the team. They're all doing amazing work, and they produce, you know, the whole project is basically what I've been espousing here. It's like, look, we need to not only overcome ideology, but we need to think of a reasonable way to persuade people to be happy and decent. And that's kind of the core mission of what we do here. And I think we're doing a fairly good job for what we are so far, but hopefully, you know, we'll get bigger and better.
Excellent. Yeah. I mean, this is, you know, a miniature dream come true. I'm really happy that you've been able to come on. And please do go to lotuseaters.com and continue listening to, you know, Carl's evolving career.